I want to say thank you for coming along at short notice. My name's Yanai, and I'm really happy, I know many of you. I'm really happy to have a chance to just share a little time and some reflections on a topic that feels really important to be engaging with. And maybe we could just begin by having really just two or three minutes sitting quietly together, just having a sense of landing from the fullness of whatever your day has involved and whatever's been going on. And that it may be that there's elements of the theme that, assuming you're aware of, that may be with you at this time, and just letting whatever's here be here. Sensing for yourself what it is to be sitting on the earth, beneath the sky, just as you are right now. Landing with yourself, wherever you are at this moment in this time. Acknowledging your body as it breathes, as it sits, and whatever expression of posture you find yourself in. Maybe take a moment to appreciate and honor this body, your body. A moment also to acknowledge the presence of others who've come also with interest and care to be present this evening. Perhaps also just acknowledging the larger body of life, body of the earth, and place that we co-inhabit together. Just before kind of beginning to speak a bit, I just want to kind of check the sense of the framework, for the intention for the framework for this evening. I'd like to take some time to speak and share some thoughts and reflections, and hope also that we will have some time for some conversations, some questions, some responses and explorations together. I know the intention with scheduling it at the time of 6 was that people might want to go to the Dharma talk at the retreat centre. My intention was not to be intending to try and get there, but if there is someone who wishes to, that's fine, and I'll endeavour to make an appropriate space and pause at that point as wish. It may be that everyone wishes to, and that's fine, then maybe I'll go too. But Without committing yourself either way, because you can see where you are, it might be you weren't planning on, after hearing a bit of this, you decide you are going. Or it might be you were planning to, and after engaging with this, you decide you're not heading back for the... But who was intending or would wish or need to be gone by, what would it be, 7 o'clock? Yeah, okay, so a couple. And that's really fine, and that's kind of what I had in mind. And my feeling was, there's many things I'd like to share and explore with you. Within what space there is for that, we'll do what can be done. And so you may be aware, as I think it was circulated, I kind of reflecting on the theme for what to call a conversation about the circumstance of our world. I could say the word we use at this point informs everything else. We could say we're in a situation, because it's a situation. It's a emergency, because it is an emergency. We could say it's a unknown, because it's also an unknown. So the circumstance we find ourselves in is a little hard to pin down, but clearly it's a circumstance of deep concern, certainly to myself, certainly to many, many people. And so, what does it mean to be Dharma practitioners in a situation of profound and seems perhaps existential concern? So, the talk of love in the time of extinction, I titled the evening. Apologies to Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Some of you will remember the novel from the 80s, I think it was. Love in the time of extinction. Love in the time of cholera, sorry. It's not about that. But this, what does it mean to be engaged with our deepest care, our deepest concern, in a situation where life is endangered in perhaps a way that we may have never encountered before as a community, as a species? One of the things that Dharma practice asks us to do is to turn towards what is true. One of the things that Dharma practice supports us to be able to do is to turn towards what is actual in our experience, what can be seen. Please, come in. Turn towards our experience is really the foundation of the transformative process that spiritual practice offers us. And yet, we're in a situation in which it is hard to turn towards. It is hard, it is not easy to turn towards the circumstance of our world. And I don't know how fully informed you might be. Some of you may well know more about what I want to say here than I do. That wouldn't be impossible or even necessarily difficult. And some of you may not. But from where I'm sitting, and as I see and understand the circumstance of our human community and of our planetary ecology, we are in a situation of dire concern. And emergency or crisis seem to be the words that most usefully articulate the situation we're in. And so, just to name this, and as I do it, just notice what it's like to hear. To receive maybe information you've heard before, maybe information you haven't heard much before, or haven't reflected on in the way we might just now. But just noticing what it is to hear someone articulate that, as again, I'm imagining many of you will be aware, last year the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change came out with a report. And in a way, it was a report on what's been going on since the 30 years that we really knew, and no one has been in any doubt in terms of the genuine sort of collective body of authoritative science as to what was happening in terms of the impact on our climate of greenhouse gas emissions. And the report that came out basically said emissions are rising, global temperature is rising, and we have very little time. In fact, 12 years, they said, before it is too late to do anything about the trajectory that we have been implacably following, actually unconsciously for 100, 150 years, and consciously, without any basis for really being able to deny, this is what our collective human culture has been engaging in, certainly since the 90s, even though some have known for quite a bit longer than that. And that we have just 12 years to endeavour to limit the greenhouse gas emissions to a level that will enable the temperature rises, which are already happening and will continue to happen, to below 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels, and ideally keep it down to 1.5 degrees, with a very clear and full statement of the catastrophic effects of what will happen if it gets even to 2 degrees. And currently the way we're going, projections vary from whether we're going to hit 2, 3, maybe 5 degrees the next 20, 40, 60, 80 years. I'm not trying to make this all about the science, but we haven't managed to address collectively a situation that affects us all and that isn't going to start happening in 10 or 12 or 20 or 30 years, but is already happening. Interestingly, with the report, it gave, as I said, 12, that was last year, 12 years, 11 years now, and counting, this amount of time for us to fundamentally reorganise how we live together in this world. The thing that is also not clear from that is that it's this panel of all the experts of all the countries of all the world reviewing all the research, of which there is a vast amount. And they spend 2 or 3 years talking about how they're going to draw it together and finding out what they agree on. So A, it's 2 or 3 years, it's working on 2 or 3 years out-of-date data, and it involves a consensus amongst a whole lot of people who like their own opinions, scientists and Dharma teachers equivalent, I'm imagining. And so it's a kind of lowest common denominator position, what everyone is willing to agree. It states the bottom, most low-level expression of concern. And many of the scientists and the research and the reports suggest much greater concern than that, that says even 12 years. And that suggests in the report that we need to get to zero carbon emissions by 2050. It doesn't take into account, A, the fact that there are very clear scientific understandings emerging now about feedback loops that suggest even as we start reducing greenhouse gas emissions, some of the processes that are already in place will accelerate the process. Two of the classic examples are just the melting of the Siberian permafrost, which will in itself be releasing and is already beginning to release in the summer methane in vast quantities. And methane is a much more potent and powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, which is the one we hear mostly about. So even if we were to reduce a lot of our emissions, some of what's already happening will be accelerating the emissions. There's feedback loops. And the other classic one that we hear about is that the melting of the polar ice caps, as they melt, their capacity to reflect sunlight back and out is reduced. And what is left is water or land, which is dark and absorbs light. So again, there's an acceleration effect. The process that's already happening feeds on itself. That's a feedback loop and amplifies. So there's that. And there's also a recognition now that there may be, and it seems very likely, are what are called tipping points. Again, they're not taken account of in the report of the IPCC. And the tipping points understanding is recognizing that certain processes, once they start happening, will have their own momentum irrespective of anything we do. So again, classic expression of that is the melting of some of the polar ice and the ice that's currently sitting on land masses, which as it melts will displace vast amounts of water in the ocean, and that as it's beginning to melt, it may actually continue to do so even if we address what's currently causing that. And that will be out of our hands very soon. Third point about that report is that it's based on research that's it's based on research that was at least 3 years old when the report came out, most of it, because that's how long they were talking about the research. And the projections from past measurements that they made that said, we think this is the track. I don't have all the slides and the detail. You have to just, take it from me if you will, that shows this is the projected increase of temperature, or this is the projected increase of carbon dioxide, or this is the projected shift in critical dynamics. The measurements that are actually being taken now are showing that we're ahead of the projection significantly. So what we thought and all those ideas were based on an idea it's going like this, and we can see that 2, 3, 4 years ago they thought it's going like this, but the actual measurements say, oh no, it's going faster than that. And so we're in a situation where even having been told, and it's serious enough, that we need to do something in the next 12 years to profoundly shift the way our society and our world functions, we see that actually that is an understatement of the truth, or of the reality that seems very likely. And some of the research and some of the reports, which there is obviously room for discussion about, they're not absolutes, science doesn't work in absolutes, but there is a recognition that there is significant potential for even human extinction in the near to medium future, not hundreds of years from now, when we think, oh, maybe in 200 years the water level will have risen and, you know, that's going to be tough, but it's a long way beyond even our imagined grand sort of descendants. It's actually happening much quicker, much sooner than that. And to give a couple of kind of particulars to that, the war in Syria is recognized as very clearly born of a famine due to climatic change that has caused significant series of harvests to fail and then mass migration and conflict and the horrific refugee migrant crisis in Europe of people seeking refuge from a place where they no longer have food security or safety. There's neither food nor civil society functioning, because that's what happens. If we get to 2 degrees, the projections are, and we're heading that way really quickly at the moment, the projections are that our grain crops will not be sustainable. The yields will drop really quickly, and there will be food shortages. It's long before the water gets up to around areas, which is what we hear is the thing, oh, that's global warming, ice caps melt, we're going to be underwater. Not for quite a while. Much more quickly than that, food security for significant numbers or proportion of our world population could be gone. Because it doesn't take too much to make the optimal conditions for grain production on which our whole developed society depends no longer be sustainable. And what we see, the human history, when there is food shortages, is actually conflict arises over resources and the breakdown of social structures. So one of the ways that extinction could happen quite quickly is that if social structures break down, nuclear reactors are not maintained with all the water they need to keep them from overheating. And it almost happened in Fukushima a few years ago, just less, 8 years ago. If the technology and the service and all of what's needed to keep those safe, there would be a risk that nuclear radiation would extend very quickly out, because the structures required to hold in place what keeps that safe. That's just one story. I'm not saying that's what is happening or going to happen, but it's modeled to say, oh, it could go this way, based on what we see already. So one report suggested there's a 1 in 20 chance that, as we're going right now, human beings are heading for relatively near-term extinction. And it's shocking and it's sobering. And it's scary to actually stop and contemplate this. Would we put our grandchildren on a plane if we knew it had a 1 in 20 chance of coming down? Oh, I mean, 1 in 20, it's a small option. You know, it's a 5% risk. I'd take that. Not if it's about death. Take a 5% risk with a lot of things, but 1 in 20 chance the plane comes down? I'm not putting my grandkids on that. And actually, it's what we're doing. This is the plane. Our grandchildren are going to be on it. the grandchildren of our friends and our family if we don't ourselves, and I don't myself have children. Not just our grandchildren. All of this living web is on the plane. And the conditions are there for a 1 in 20. It's like, whoa, just a moment. What are we doing? And you will also perhaps have been aware this year, the IPBES report, again, the UN report on biodiversity and habitats and species, recognizing an accelerating and rapid loss of species, of biodiversity and of ecological systems such that rates of extinction and dying off of species, both animals, plants and others, is happening and accelerating at shocking and alarming rates. And it's very clearly traced and trackable to the way our human activity and culture is happening on this planet. Again, there are many things one could say about this, but one of the images that stays with me, and it's a particular one, there are many, was an image I saw of the current situation of mammalian biomass on our planet, which means basically how all the body weight of all the mammals that currently exist is divided up. You might wonder where this is going. So actually, human beings currently make up 36, by weight, not by numbers, but by weight, added all together, 36% of the mammalian, that's all the soft, warm-blooded creatures on the planet and in the seas. We make up 36% of them by mass. Our food, creatures that are farmed for human consumption, make up 60% of the current mammalian biomass in our world. And so the image that you see is a human being looking about a third of the size of the page, a cow looking about two-thirds of the size of the page, and in a very small corner, an image of what looks like on the screen, I think, a rhinoceros. Wild mammals make up 4% of the total mammals left in the world. And that's including the whales and the hippopotami and the elephants and, of course, the chipmunks too. And all the other warm-blooded creatures of the same family that we are, mammals, there's only that many that are able to live on this planet. And we and our food is most of the mammals that are here. We, I speak collectively. We choose or not to eat such creatures. And we hear and we know. If we pay attention to the news of the plastic in our oceans. I don't know if you heard of or saw the movie Albatross. Profoundly touching and moving. Shocking. Tracking a vast colony of albatross who live on Midway Island out in the Pacific. And the encounter of this remarkable creature, these birds, with the human waste floating in the ocean. And to see a mother albatross feeding a piece of plastic to her chick, unable to any longer distinguish it from food, and to see the images of dead birds who inside their bodies it's full of plastic pieces, or whales washed up, vast amounts. This is, you know, it's like Dharma practice resources us to turn towards what is not easy to bear. And this information is not easy to bear. So I invite you to just take a moment and notice how it lands for you. It's not intended to be distressing, but it is, we actually let it in. And I'm not saying it because I want you to be distressed. but because it's important that we consider this in our lives, in the choices and the options we take. And if anyone would like to just share a word or a phrase, not a long conversation, but does anyone have a response to hear? Again, it might be you've heard it before. Maybe you've heard it more fully and more precisely articulated, and that's really fine. If you might. But what's it like to hear that just now? Just to hear it said, as simply as I'm endeavouring to say it. I mean, I'm listening myself as I hear, because I too can get a little bit distant from the, not, it's not information. It comes as information, but it's not information. It's weighty. Does anyone have a response they want to articulate? Yeah, like a weight on the heart. I feel a sense of, like, it's sort of, there's a kind of alertness it calls as well. It's like, wow, really? Now, I was just reading through some of the thoughts I was going to bring just earlier, and yet I noticed that speaking it, actually saying it, oh, there's something about that. Guilt. Right, so we can feel like, wow, I've done this, or we've done this, and that sense of, can be remorse of feeling sorrow, or it can feel kind of like, a bit like more judgment or blame in the form of guilt of, oops, that's bad, I'm bad, or we're bad. Yeah.
Overwhelming.
Yeah. Yeah. Overwhelming. It's like, how do I make sense of, how do I hold that? It's almost like beyond me as a human. Yeah. Yeah. Claustrophobia. Right, so we can feel like something closing around us, or no space, no, yeah. Yeah, the if we actually sit with and allow those all the responses we've heard and all the others that will also be happening, one of the things that may also come is a sense of, I want to respond to this. The response of the compassionate heart to dukkha. And this is dukkha. This is dukkha. Serious. It's one thing to talk about birth, aging, decay and death at a personal level or even for one's loved ones, but for the whole thing? For everything? Wow, dukkha. And the compassion of our heart is, I want to respond to this. And yet, it can also seem and appear that, how can I make a response to this? So the talk that I saw the slide in, which comes from Extinction Rebellion, the slide I was describing about mammalian biomass, is called Heading for Extinction and What to Do About It. And I think these things go together. I mean, some of you, I think, have heard or sort of possibly watched this talk, and this what I'm speaking here is not that talk. But that sense of what to do about it, what can I do? When I first encountered the movement, Extinction Rebellion, which I'd like to speak a little bit about and my experience with, something in my heart lit up, because it seemed to me there was a movement that had, as well as the passion of the activists for engaging with clear need for action, it seemed this movement also had the wisdom of the spiritual practitioner in understanding how one needs to engage in order for it to be both sustainable and transformative and not become part of the actual problem dynamic. I'm not saying it's a perfect expression of that, but my early engagement with activism as a young man ended at the point where I realized that there was so much anger towards the causes of the problems, the recognized and often correctly, accurately diagnosed, this is who's causing the trouble, this is who's doing the thing that's wrong. And that anger and unchallenged and somehow unhandled led to both a lot of extreme sort of relating with aggression to others, and ultimately to each other and even oneself in the process of engagement. So much activism has founded on the breaking down of relationships internally, or the overwhelm individually of this person, someone who is driving themselves out of aversion and anger rather than love. And that one of the first things that stood out to me was that the response here needs to come from love and not be about blaming. And I was having a conversation with somebody at lunch today about the question of blaming. Was that lunch? It might have been not today. I can't remember where it was now. But recently. And that sense of how we easily, as someone said, felt guilty. And then we kind of feel like, I can't do anything, it's too big, and I'm part of the problem, which is true. But we somehow disempower ourselves, because in a paradigm of blaming, if I'm part of the problem, then I've got no basis for calling for a change. It's like, sorry, you're doing it too. How can you say we should change? And this is actually fundamentally untrue and unhelpful, because when we understand that what we're dealing with is not something for which individual responses are the primary issue. It's needed, of course, it's great, and so far as we can all do things in the way we live our lives, that is helpful. But this is way beyond individual shifts here. We need collective response. The capacity of the state is the vehicle for making a response at the level of emergency that we face. And we have clear history around the way that can happen, and happen urgently when needed. And classic, you know, often brought up is in the war, the Second World War, for instance, the whole economy, because it's existential, because actually we need to change or die here, or be, in that case, overrun and facing sort of forces of fascism, in that case, in Europe and in America, and in Asia. The whole changing of the economy to do what has to be done can be done. And part of what's in the IPCC report is actually, yes, we can do this. But equally, we don't yet have the political will. And we don't have the social awareness to drive that is needed. So part of why it's hard to turn towards this is because it's distressing, it's grievous, it's profoundly painful and distressing to acknowledge the situation, and we have the tendency to somehow feel either we blame ourselves, or if I try to speak out, I'll be just said, and oh, but you drove over here in your car, didn't you? Isn't that the problem? And in one sense, yes, but actually there's a larger systemic issue around why it is that public money goes into supporting private transportation, not collective transportation. And that's only going to be resolved at a collective level. The system is set up to keep channeling us in to the patterns of behaviour that then we might feel bad about. So I think there's something here about understanding that. And so there's two things that are really needed. One is actually the shift in our collective awareness of the nature of the problem, that it is immediate and it is existential. It's like contemplating death. We do this in Dharma practice. Oh, yes, I too will not escape this. But this is at another whole level. And yet with that practice, with that training of Maranasati, contemplating our mortality, we actually have a ground, perhaps more than many, for engaging with what this is. Because of course, at some level, sure, yeah, who says a planet should live its natural lifestyle any more than any one individual who might not and might die young? And this planet may be one of those planets where the living ecosystem, as we know it at least, perhaps dies young or doesn't sustain this manifestation of life. But the issue here isn't about whether or not we live or live forever, because of course we don't, and collectively, you know, at some point the sun runs out of neutrons or whatever it is to sort of keep itself cooking and keep this planet warm, and the whole thing will run down, but it's probably quite a long way away in terms of that progression. So it's not about avoiding the end any more than Dharma practice about avoiding somehow coming to the end of our life. But it's like, how will we live? How will we be here in this time? What will we have done with our lives? And, you know, the question that is asked, how will we look to our children and their children? And what will we say if they ask us, you know, what did you do when you knew? Because that's a really painful thing to sit with. What did I do once I knew? Beautiful poem by Drew Dillinger, which I didn't manage to bring with me, which that was one of the questions he found himself being asked by his granddaughter, I think, in a dream. And so one of the questions here for us is, you know, is Gail Bradbrook, one of the founders of Extinction Rebellion, she says, what does it mean to be a good ancestor? Brings me to Extinction Rebellion and nonviolent civil disobedience. When I encountered this movement called Extinction Rebellion, basically rebelling against the fact that we're heading for extinction and we're not doing a lot about it, we're actually not even doing what we can do about it. It may be beyond our control already, it might be already, and there are certain research articles and sort of views that say, actually, it might already be too late. We might not actually be able to stop this process that's going to lead to at least profound social breakdown and possibly human extinction. That might be already gone, according to some analysis of the information. But we have the opportunity to respond because we are human beings that care. To a situation that we're in that isn't of our personal making but which we are part of. And so okay, before I just go on to talk a little bit about nonviolent civil disobedience, I think a really useful way to understand this is in the lens of addiction. It's like the doctors told us, if we keep doing this, it's going to kill us. But we can't not, it seems, at some level. Partly because to actually face the truth of it is too painful and overwhelming, and unless we're trained and supported and collectively turned towards this, we can't really face the implications of it. It's just too painful for most of us, most of the time. And because there are those who, in whatever degree of blindness they're functioning, are invested in and currently profiting from, and therefore advocating for and furthering the very activities of our industrial society that are creating and accelerating the problem. And the investment of the fossil fuel industry, just to pick one, and there are many, is remarkable in this. The well-documented information that they knew about climate change in the 60s, that they chose not to tell anyone else. They chose to lobby to confuse the science. And at the same time, they built oil drilling platforms higher off the seafloor, knowing the water was rising. Staggering cynicism, self-interest, and some degree of spiritual blindness in imagining that this was actually to be for their well-being. Choosing somehow making more profit with welfare. But staggering to think funding groups and science and articulations that blurred and confused what is so evident now. In the same way the tobacco industry did around tobacco, the alcohol industry still does around alcohol, the codeine pain-killing opiate-derived painkilling industry has been doing in recent times with the current crisis and that, we see that corporate culture is bereft of ethicality. Not all people in it or all companies at all, but it's not built on it. It's not in the nature of it. It's to make money, and it does it. But we can't eat money. We know that. We can't actually use money to sustain our economy if our economy is being destroyed. So what's needed is to wake people up. Collective awareness needs to be raised. And pressure needs to be brought to bear on the political structures which are currently dependent upon the finance they get from where the corporate world, because getting elected involves lots of money, and basically where the money is where the direction seems to be coming from much of the time. That's pretty simplistic analysis. I could pick it apart myself in some ways, but, and I'm sure you could too, but just in terms of broad brush strokes, because you know, we're not going to be here all evening, unless you choose to be. There is clear research, scientific empirical research, that shows that the way to make a change in the face of what is essentially an unaccountable political and economic structure, which has lost its accountability, despite being called democratic, looking as if it might be. To a certain degree, of course, it is in our cultures and in this country, in England where I live, in New Zealand where I come from. But at another level, we can see that something has been lost, that non-violent civil disobedience is actually an effective transformative vehicle, and it is this which is being called for. It's this which I've been engaged in for the last 8 months. And there's something remarkable about what happens when one actually says and recognises, actually, the way the system is working right now has to be challenged. And it can't be done from entirely staying within the rules, because the rules are favouring the status quo over wisdom, over compassion, over well-being. And that there is effectively a breach in the social contract to which authority is given to government and law to maintain the well-being of the human and living community if it's not actually doing that. And right now it isn't. Right now it isn't. And in that, you could say the rupture, fracture, or the breaking of the social contract calls or demands a response that steps outside of the normal frameworks. And just as the American Civil Rights Movement, inspired by Rosa Parks, led by Martin Luther King, was able to actually shift an entrenched and incredibly strongly established pattern of segregation, discrimination, and oppression. Not that it's a finished job, but at least at the structural legal level, to shift that profoundly is one of the recent expressions of non-violent civil disobedience, being willing to break the law, to sit in the wrong place on the bus. Likewise, in India, the Indian independence movement led by Gandhi and others, Nehru also, and that facing the might of the British colonial army, the greatest colonial power of that time or possibly any time, was able to overturn it. Because there is something about when human beings are willing to take a risk with their own well-being on behalf of the greater good that is profoundly powerful. That doesn't require everybody to be doing that. It in fact only requires a small proportion of people. There's a wonderful TED talk by Erica Chenoweth who speaks about her research in this regard, and that in fact any movement that gets 3.5% of the population, any movement engaging in non-violent civil disobedience that can engage actively 3.5% of the population has succeeded. Many have succeeded with less, but with that many, every time it has been successful. And that 50% of the movements in the world involving at least 1,000 people over the last 150 years, half of the ones that were running from nonviolent civil disobedience have succeeded. Of those that involved violence, only a quarter succeeded. And most of those actually led to repressive and authoritarian or totalitarian regimes because they validated violence as the means for control and change. To validate sacrifice, courage, and vulnerability as the foundation for bringing about change. This is something powerful, and this is something very close, I think, to what we learn about and understand in Dharma practice. That's been my experience. And so I have, over the last, as I said, 8 months, been involved in beginning knowing very little, it seemed, about what it is to go and stand somewhere and say, okay, we're standing here, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to impede your progress if you needed to get across the bridge, but we're staying here because we need someone to listen to what's going on, to be arrested, to be threatened and in the process of being prosecuted. To do things like this with a group of people who care and are doing it because they care about a greater well-being than just their personal comfort or convenience or maintaining their particular privilege and benefits within a system that so many people are subject to oppression and exploitation and in not entirely indirect ways, likewise subject to disease, starvation and death because of how it functions. To do that is something that has, I would say, a spiritual power to it that is transformative within the collective field of the social consciousness, which is a field of experience which is in many ways also parallels what we can work with as our own, what we call individual, though not entirely separate or solid, experience of consciousness. There's an image that you may be familiar with of the Buddha, often standing, occasionally sitting, like this, or like this. Anyone know the name of the mudra? The Abhaya mudra. It means fearless. Sorry? Yeah. Fearless, no fear. Or I would say also courageous, which is what... It's not about the absence of fear. Courage is not the absence of fear, but the willingness to act on what is true and right as opposed to on the fear itself. Interestingly, when someone first said to me, would you be willing to glue yourself to a door? I thought, I really don't want to do that. That sounds like a bad idea. I'll pass. And yet I was surprised to find a few months later myself agreeing with a group of people to glue myself. And that's how you do it. You glue yourself to a door. It's really interesting that it was the same mudra. That's the basic way you do it. The only other way you would do it, if you're standing up, I'll stand up, you do it. You don't want to put it somewhere far away or something like that because that's really uncomfortable. You want it just where you can be relaxed. It's still pretty hard work because that bit of you can't move for a while. It's really interesting how having practiced and being in a position and choosing not to move, meditation, ever happened to you in that? That you decided, I'll just stay with this when you had a choice and to put yourself in a situation where you no longer have a choice. Because by being attached to this place, you can actually talk to someone who would otherwise be able to avoid you. This was for a conference of the petroleum industry in London, who were basically gathering all these senior petroleum industry executives and senior state ministers from oil states and the trade minister from the UK and others. And they're basically saying, well, if you read the agenda for the conference, how can we dig more fossil fuels out of the ground? How can we exploit the new reserves we think we found in Africa and also make it look like we're actually supporting the Paris Accords of reducing climate greenhouse gas emissions? We already have more reserves that if we burnt them, we'd be way over the targets. We'd have completely cooked our planet. There's no way it's justifiable to seek any more. And yet, these people are doing that. So a group of us, it's very interesting. We glued ourselves to the doors of the hotel. So they had to talk to us as they went past. It took 4 hours before the police removed us. It's quite a process. It was very interesting because we just said to them, think about your children. Think about our children. We're very clear. We're not making them bad or blaming them. Just think about your children when you're doing this. I was holding a sign at one point that said, the other hand, actually, climate change equals mass murder. It's like if you intentionally continue on a course of action that is going to bring about the death of hundreds and thousands, even if it's happening within what is currently a legally permissible framework, when you step back and see that, that's what happened with the Holocaust. That was a legally enacted framework of law that allowed what happened in Europe to happen. Take the lives of 6,000 members of the Jewish community, and my great-grandfather was one of them. Sorry, 6 million. I think my mind is affected by just speaking about the territory. My father and my grandparents were also in the camps. They survived. And I have the sense of, oh, when you look at that from a distance, it's obvious that that is illegal, what happened. Even though the laws of the countries at the time and the powers in be that were in control of those countries, it was legal within them. We're in that situation now. We have a situation where if history is fortunate enough to be able to look back on this, we'll say, oh, that was illegal. There's no way those laws could be validated. But it requires collective international action in that regard. And it also requires national action to raise the consciousness. We see those people in situations where something is happening that is not acceptable who have found the courage and the willingness to step up and say, no, I will not participate, or I will challenge. What happens when we engage in this way, what is really interesting is that it gets the attention of the government and the media and the community, causing disruption by blocking a conference, or causing major disruption by occupying a bridge for a week in the middle of London, a central conduit for transport, as we did in April. And I was part of the group that sort of, or the team that sort of coordinated and led or held that site within the action that we did in the International Rebellion. Causes a lot of people trouble. It's really annoying when you're trying to get somewhere and, somebody's blocked your way. I had the trouble too. At one point when I was arrested, the police van took hours to come and get us because somebody had blocked the bridge. It's like, and we were standing there in the sun slowly cooking. Interestingly, I got to make friends with the police officer because there was enough time to say, hey, you know, your family, you got one? How do you feel about what's happening? Are you concerned? I'm concerned. That's why I'm here. So rather than seeing them as oppositional, it's like, oh, can we engage with these people? Because they're people and they have children. One point when we were being arrested on the last night of the holding of the Waterloo Bridge, as you can see, if you wish, a YouTube clip that Extinction Rebellion have put out called Waterloo Uprising, which is a 3-minute sort of journey through that story. And as we were finally, over the course of the week, about 600 of us were arrested. And on the last evening where we managed to, the last point where they finally managed to remove us, and they tried on many occasions, coming with hundreds of police officers, but every time they did, there were more of us that were willing to stand there and say, no, I'm not leaving, and therefore be arrested. And each time we get arrested, they have to carry us, and it takes 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 of them, depending how big you are, and it takes a lot of time and trouble, and they run out of places to put us, and they run out of vans to move us with, and in the end, they give up, and we're still there. And the final times, you know, we were chanting as they came, police, we love you. We're doing this for your children too. And they were being affected. They were being touched. It's like they are trained to deal with aggression and violence and aggro. They're not trained to deal with a vulnerable, open heart saying, we're concerned. It's also interesting, and a few of my friends who have Dharma practice who are there, we joked about having the opportunity for a day retreat at Her Majesty's Ashram. Because you get a little room. It's got an ensuite toilet, it's got a bed, they give you 3 meals a day. They can't keep you for more than 24 hours. And it's like, okay, those were the most relaxed periods of the whole week. It's kind of interesting when you turn it around, because it's no longer something shameful in which you are being somehow excluded from the community because you've become a bad person. You've been arrested and the force of the law is applied to you. But actually, this is part of being in a community. This is part of actually holding my community. And, you know, I chanted in those rooms, in those cells. It was like, what has gone on in here before I came? My gosh, people have been scared and angry and distressed and confused and oppressed. Maybe mishandled. Just to sit there and think, wow, okay, can I, you know, and to chant the refuges, to chant. I'm not much of a musical chanter, as some of you might know, but it's great not to have to be embarrassed, because what the hell, they've already put me in prison or in a cell, you know, they're not going to arrest me for singing badly at this point. And just something amazing about how the resources of that just sense of, oh, look, can I just leave an atmosphere in here of kindness, of love, as a practice. And as I said, that, you know, this thing of, in one action, I was locked to two friends to blockade the entrance to the BBC, because we were saying, look, you've got to say the truth. You've got to say what's actually happening. Report this in the news. And they are, much more now. But, like, you know, I can't itch my nose, because my hands are attached to my friends. And it's like, what do you do with that? Well, actually, the interesting thing is you have someone else there who comes and scratches your nose. Of course, they don't scratch the right bits. Oh, no, over there. Okay, could you stick something near my nose and then I can scratch it? But it's really interesting also that sense of being supportive and supporting each other and engaging in action. I found myself in a similar way to the way you can with someone. You do a retreat together, you sit by them, you don't know them at all, and at the end of 10 days you love them. Similarly, going into doing these kind of actions with people, the only thing we knew about each other was that we were willing to do this together. And wow, such deep connections, such sweet connections. I'm just going to say a couple of things and then pause. I hope that's okay, timing-wise. I'll try and do this concisely. And then we'll maybe take a little more, those who wish. It's really interesting that causing disruption gets people's attention. Even if they don't like what you're doing to them, it gets them to pay attention. Some of the people who get disrupted end up finding out why we're doing it and joining. Some of them get really angry, and of course the certain elements of the press would rather put their quotes on it. You know, oh, they really messed up my day. But actually, as many people came along and said, thank you, I know, and I'm really glad. And some of them said, oh, I think I'm going to join in on the basis of having been disrupted. It's like getting people's attention. And it actually gets the government's attention too, because you're starting to impact the flow of money. As soon as you affect transport and communications, you've got your finger on the pipe through which the money moves. And then suddenly you've got power, as if you had, I don't have £120 million to influence the government with, but if a group of us can go and block London so it costs the economy £120 million, then, oh, suddenly we're playing in the major league and the government's coming to talk, because if we do that again and again and again, it's a problem. So it's interesting. Oh, that's really empowering. Just soft human bodies willing to take a bit of a risk, willing to, in a way, cash up some of the privilege that I have and others have. I don't have children to look after. I have a place to live. I don't have an employer who will fire me for getting into trouble. I'm fortunate. Not everyone is. There are many other people that are needed to support one person there. Just like one person in a fire service who'll go into a burning building will have dozens behind them sitting at the desk, driving the engine, you know, ordering the equipment. All of those jobs are all equally important. So it's not just about the frontline, front edge thing. But that's part of it. You do also need some people who go into the building. And we'd all understand, I think, that if a burning, there's a building on fire and there's children in the trapped in there, that it's okay to knock down the door to get in. That's obvious. It's also okay to knock some bystanders out of the way if they're just gawping and they're not helping to get in. That's a little bit what it feels like sometimes. And non-violent civil disobedience is exactly what we do when we practice meditation. The first thing we notice is we start off being angry with all the people who've created the conditions in my life. We realize, that doesn't help. And then we start getting angry with me for keeping on doing all these unskillful things I keep doing. We realize that doesn't help. Nonviolence in terms of practice is actually beginning to soften and forgive others and ourselves for all the screw-ups of our lives. And then see, okay, what can I do here? Because civil disobedience internally is the process in which we begin to learn and to recognize the unhelpful injunctions and prohibitions that internally constrain us from acting according to our truth, our love, and our wisdom. The things that say you can't do this, you must do that. Even though we know doing the thing we can, something is saying I can't do it, doing that would be actually a good thing. But I can't. Or this, you got to, you must, and I know it's not going to be good for me or the world, but I do. Those internal injunctions, freedom, inner freedom and practice is learning about not to be controlled and bound by them. Applied at a larger social level, nonviolent civil disobedience is that same practice. Learning to keep one's heart open. So it's not about attacking, judging, or blaming, but about responding in such way as one feels able. Even if that means transgressing some of the collective agreements. Because the basis for those agreements is that the collective, in a way, support for them is based on the service of our collective greater well-being. And when that is no longer the case, as Thoreau said, when the law is unjust, the just must break the law. Civil disobedience. And he was talking about the slave trade, and he was talking about the wars against the indigenous peoples of this country. And so to finish Martin Luther King, with Martin Luther King, finish this piece at least, who said, never be afraid to do what's right. The punishments of society are insignificant in comparison to the injury we do to our soul when we turn away. And so, the two things. One, I'd just like to invite you again to just take a moment to feel, connect with your body. Notice how you are, where you are right now. I would invite you to take a moment to honor yourself just for bringing yourself into this place and into contact with this territory, which is not a casual choice or an easy option. And I want to really ask you to honor your aspiration to find out what may be true and right for you. So important that we don't pick up an idea of what we should do, or that someone else did something, so I should. It's no, let's see what your path is. Let's see what your offering is. Rumi said, you know, let what we love be what we do. There are 1,000 ways to kneel down and kiss the earth. There are 1,000 ways to kneel down and save the earth. We have to bow humility to the size of what we're here engaged with. And so may our care and our concern find expression, conversation and connection. And in such responses as feel true for us. May there be healing. May there be safety and well-being and peace in our hearts and in the world. No matter what trajectory we travel, ourselves or together. May the Dharma support us to find what is true, to live that.